Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Thank you. Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
One woman and a sewing machine.
No.
Okay, take a guess. I've been doing it since 2008. So just a random guess. How much?
90,000.
How much?
90,000? No, more than that.
It is a little higher. It's less than 300. $250,000.
Right.
One woman and a sewing machine. I was a stay-at-home mom. We had three children at the time. And it was like president of PTA. My husband was a captain of an Airbus. It was a good life. Until a letter came in the mail to let me know that my husband knows that the airline that he had worked for 20 years was filing bankruptcy and he would be unemployed. So, this is my husband. On the couch. I don't know if you've ever lost your identity, but it's no fun. And I think women do better with that than men. It's especially no fun for men. Here's my husband Darren on the couch, and he stayed there for quite some time. And both of our dreams, in a sense, were flushed down the toilet because all I ever wanted to be was a mom. So I didn't want to have to leave these kids. And put them in daycare, and I also was holding out a little bit of hope that he would fly again, and that would mean traveling, and so it was kind of pointless for me to go and get a full-time job, and then what do I do with these children, right? Mm-hmm. So I sat and spent 3 days about, because it's pure panic. You go from a nice income to know when to come. You've got to do something. What can I do? What can I do? I went to that light is good mentality, and I thought, if we have to redesign our whole life, we're going to do something that we love. So Darren couldn't even talk about love. He's still on the couch. So I said, what do I love? I know I love babies, and I know I love bags. I still really love bags, and then I'm kind of looking for a grandbaby. So I thought initially, this is before the big handmade craze. Etsy, I think they just celebrated their 13th birthday. So this is in 2006. So the wave hadn't hit yet with handmade goods. So I thought, I'll buy other people's goods and resell them on my .com. And I thought, that's a good idea. I can do that and stay at home with the kids. And so the product started arriving. Most of it I was getting off eBay. And I could see like little tiny flaws and imperfections. I had ideas. Oh, if they would have just done this, it'd be so much better. That probably happens to y'all when you're working. And so I just couldn't help myself, and I went and bought a sewing machine, which puts me down here at the novice level. This is the person who borrows the machine and then asks you to thread it for them. They're going to get real far since the ball runs out, right? It's like, what do I do with it now? And they're knocking at your door. Can you find this bobbin for me? Yeah. So I got a sewing machine. I'm sitting at our dining room table, which is right inside of our front door. And it wasn't very long. You know how the fabric addiction works. Pretty fast, and there's no stopping it. Have any of you recovered?
No.
Yeah. So I have pictures of our youngest daughter, Isabel, who's now 9, as an infant, in a pile of remnants this high. I have a problem. So I fill our dining room with fabric, and I have a sewing machine. And I'm learning slowly how to sew and not scream at people when they interrupt me. I make it through that phase of the business. And I have a product that's very basic, but my friends and neighbors will buy it probably because they feel really bad on me because Darren is still on the couch. So I take these bags to the high school and have a craft fair. And I sold $500, which I was like, wow, this is fun. I like having my own money. And we can eat this week, honey. So I then had a little better product, and I took that to eBay. Because there actually was a really nice handmade division of eBay back in 2006. And I did very well on eBay. I made power seller status and was consistently earning at least $500 a month, which is buying up groceries, and some food is better than no food. So then in 2008, one of my eBay customers told me about Etsy. And for me, Etsy really was like overnight success. I had a sale in just a few hours, and sales were consistent. They were way better than eBay because they have this very targeted customer base. When you go to Etsy, you're looking for handmade. When you go to eBay, you could be looking for anything, right? So I was had that instant success. So Darren had a job again, another airline. We decided we should have a fourth kid. I was having a great time running my little business. We had some extra money. Guess what happened? He lost his second airline job. And I'm super pregnant. And that was before we had any health care laws to protect us. So now we don't have a job. We have a baby on the way. And we have no health insurance. That was terrifying. That bad feeling, and he's so Well, I don't know if it's lucky because he gave up his dream, but he did decide to get out of aviation and he became a subcontractor. And so he's still in aviation, so he's able to use his education background, but he is not doing what he loves. But in that process, his bridge was stabilized and the business was so big now because I worked so hard that it was taking up our entire basement. So I took a leap of faith and I negotiated my first commercial lease. Has anyone ever been to Middleburg, Virginia?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It just really is so picturesque and the people are amazing. It's like a fairy tale town.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed there and that was a huge hurdle for me as, you know, as what I went through this mentality that, oh, I'm just a mom, to then I'm just a seller. And I really doubted, why would anyone seriously lease me their space, right? Well, somewhere in there between leasing this cute little lot in Middleburg and being featured in Southern Living magazine, it clicked in my head that I might be a real businesswoman, or entrepreneur at least. And I was able to take my sales, and at this point it's still just me and my baby sewing all day long. I took the sales from $20,000 a year to $60,000 a year, making stuff for people, and they were buying it as fast as I could make it. I had at one point at the height of this, I call it my Southern Living craze, I had 8 weeks of backlog orders, walls of fabric packages, because I would let them choose their own fabric online, just waiting for me to even open to see what was in there. And so then I got brave and said, oh, I should open a boutique in Middleburg. Luckily, I had fairly decent rent, but it was street-level boutique. So what I didn't know was, when you own a boutique, you don't have customers coming in all year, especially in a town like Middleburg. It's very seasonal. When the weather's good, you go walk around Middleburg. You don't walk around Middleburg in the winter. So I had this lease, and I had to now sew as hard as I was sewing before, fill all my Etsy orders and pay this rent and fill the store. That's the part I underestimated. How am I going to fill this store up? I don't have time to make all this product. And what happens if you go in a store and there's not much to look at, right? And I'm taking it serious. So I had to get other people to make things and bring them into my store. And luckily people were excited to do that because they too loved Middleburg. And a lot of people would come into the shop and ask me, oh, I want to do what you do, how can I do it? And I said, you can sell your stuff right here. I don't have time to fill the store. So I gave them a really good deal. It was like a 60-40 split in their favor. But what I didn't realize was when they would come, we would start collaborating. There was like this energy, this amazing, I call it like a high, or they might say in the zone, and time would cease for me, and I was so happy to just be networking with them. And I knew then, that's the good stuff. How do I get more of that? But I never could figure out how to balance those winter months and the high rent and all of that so it would make financial sense to keep that boutique open. But I wanted to find a way to keep those beautiful people in my life. So I made the hard decision. I closed that store. And it was a hard goodbye, but I said goodbye to everybody. A lot of people were sad, but it just wasn't going to make financial sense to do that. So I don't look at that as a failure. I say I earned my MBA. I spent that much money. And I probably learned more than I would teach you if I had gone to school. So right before I closed that shop, I founded SewAspire.com, which is a YouTube channel. And initially I thought I want to reach 10,000 people. And that was just an outrageous number that I just picked to throw out there. I have one subscriber. Guess who it was?
No.
My husband. I tell the kids, I'm going to be a YouTuber. They're teenagers. So they're like, okay, Mom. So my body fell so low. I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't. My first videos, I don't have the heart to delete them because they're proof of what a dork I was. So I keep them out there anyway. And sometimes people will watch them and they have their nerve to go, oh, you ought to do this. There's 100 more videos after that. Fast forward. So I did that, and I started with that one loyal fan that I have, and closed the shop, and then I moved into a little tiny, probably, what do you think that space was like? Less than 200 square feet, tiny one room commercial space in the Plains, Virginia, which is just a little bit up the road from Middleburg. And I really, at that point, was still kind of licking my wounds from the shop and just wanted to figure out who I was going to be and how I was getting there. So there was one window in the place, and it faced another building, and there was a vine at the side of the building. So by summertime, I had no light. One rinky-dink light at the top. And so I stayed there, and my focus was growing that YouTube channel. I would consistently produce free tutorials for them once a week, and then growing my Etsy business. Now, at this time, I didn't have any more babies and diapers, so I didn't really carry a diaper bag anymore, so I was finding it harder to communicate with new moms. I did have was a camera and 4 beautiful children, so I had grown very fond of photography. And so I adapted that product line to the camera bag, which I brought some samples to show my scrappy patchwork camera bag. And this, the padding on this, believe it or not, is baby crib, the new phones were baby crib bags. So my mom had was still thinking for my camera. We're going to keep that good shape. So I started making camera bags and then camera strap covers, because you know how the camera strap is so irritating on the neck, and then there's a little pocket there for your lens cap. I invested in an embroidery machine. Does anybody have an embroidery machine? Yeah, a lot of fun too. Thread addiction, right after fabric addiction.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I do now in my Etsy shop, is make custom camera bags and camera strap covers. And then the Etsy shop's always been great, so I had no problem building up that. And I'm slowly growing this YouTube channel, and now we're up to almost 25,000 subscribers when I turn that focus onto that. So because I had so much extra time running these two businesses, just kidding, I launched another business called theforcing.com, because I was still not getting my fix with these women that I miss so much. So the Forcing I just launched last October, and it's a platform to mentor and coach other women who think they're just moms or just sewers, and they want to break into the Etsy world or any form or fashion of selling your product. So I launched that, and that's the facet of my business that I'm most excited about, because I want to get back there working with those women and those makers again, because it's exactly the feeling I had here when I saw what you all are doing. This stuff does change the world. It's not just sewing or just quilting, and you all know that, so I'm preaching to the choir, but when you're passionate about something like that, you'll do anything to get back there and have more of that. So what I did in May, because now this little studio is closing in on me, and that vine's growing like crazy, and I have no light, and I want to do all these things, I moved into my dream studio. It's on the third floor of the same building, 500 square feet. I have a back office. I have so much sunlight. It's unbelievable. And if you go to the YouTube channel, there's a tour of it, so you can see it. All my fabric bibs, 20 sewing machines fixed. I need that many, right? My husband, God bless him. He never asked any questions. Okay, honey. And I just keep loading it in. So that's what I'm doing now. And we've set some big goals for the YouTube channel. Actually, my 9-year-old set this goal. I woke up one Saturday morning to her going, Mom, do you realize you can get this plaque from YouTube when you reach 100,000 subscribers? I'm like, oh, really? I said, Mom, that's nice. She keeps talking about. So I looked it up. It's a legit thing. They'll send you this plaque. And she was so excited about it. And I said, okay, so we probably can't get to 100,000 subscribers because I made it this far. I'm like, what, 25% of the way down? I said, all right, what do you want to do when we get 100,000 subscribers? And we decided we're going to go in a hot air balloon.
Yeah.
So then, because my children are overachievers, I don't know how that happened.
I can't imagine where
we went wrong. Your dad was on the couch. They look at me and they go, Mom, what are you going to do when you get to 1 million subscribers? Okay, we're going to ride elephants in India. Is that good enough? So that's my story. But I want to leave you with a quote, my favorite quote, and a thought. So in case you forget everything else I said tonight. So the quote, forever, I thought, was by someone named George Eliot. And I have silver bookmark there. My husband found it on an airplane more than a decade ago, because you know when they clean the airplanes, people leave stuff behind.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that, and he thought it reminded him of me. He brought it home to me. He had no idea. I asked him about it the other day. He had no idea I still have it. And I read it every day when I go to work. And it says, it is never too late to be what you might have been. George Eliot. I'm assuming George is a man. All these years. But I knew I was coming here and I was using this quote, so I said, I better Google George and make sure he's not a freak. And I'm going to quote him. George is a woman. That was her pen name. And she was a very famous Victorian age author who wanted her work to be respected. And she used a man's name. That was in the 1800s. So, and her real name is Marianne Evans. So if Marianne knew that to be the truth in the 1800s, we can believe it today in 2018. So it's never too late. That's the first thought. And then the second thought / lesson is, you must have more than one dream in this lifetime. Okay? It's all right to have more than one dream and chase it. And you are the only person that has to believe in your dream. Okay?
Well done.
On the old Clifton Road, under the corner tree of the 11th Street, is a roadside tailor shop of Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, a resident of Neelam Colony, sits under the tree every day with a TV dish fixed on the tree trunk, which serves as a shade. Muhammad Ali remains busy throughout the day in stitching clothes that can get him something to support his family. When he first started his work as a tailor, he would cater government officials, but now he is left with customers such as security guards, drivers, and waiters, who are looking for cheap and quick stitching. However, he complains that during the last 5 years, worsening law and order situation has affected his business badly.
कितने लोगों का ये हमारे माशाल्लाह चार बच्चे थे, एक बीवी थी, दो बच्चियाँ थी, बस उनको मजदूरी करके मतलब उनको पढ़ाया भी है. खिलाया भी है सब कोई किया है बस अभी अभी जो है ना अभी हिसाब किताब खत्म ही होने वाला है बस अगले साल अल्लाह ताला ने बुलाया अपने घर में ये काम छोड़ देंगे बस.
His son Muhammad Akram is also part of this business. Akram says that he has seen his father working very hard from the very beginning and still continues to do so.
मैं यही देखा कि जब से मैं इनको साथ काम करा रहा हूँ ना, जब से शुरू से यही काम कर रहे हैं इधर बैठ के, बस यही लाते हैं, बस यही करते हैं और कपड़े सीते रहते हैं.
Despite the financial hardships faced by Muhammad Ali, his will and determination serves as an inspiration for others to work hard to earn a decent living. Ahmed Jung, Express 24/7, Karachi.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word, because as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurt himself.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also don't know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year, one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Producing uniforms for our nation's more than 1 million member military is a big job. In Cleveland, Ohio, one company hires people who might otherwise have difficulty finding work. From IdeaStream, the PBS station in Cleveland, Darielle Snipes has the story.
Like the women who vow to fight for our freedom, the employees at Vocational Guidance Services, or VGS, fight their own personal battle each day that comes in the form of a physical or cognitive disability.
I'm visually impaired. I was born legally blind with sight.
I have mild autism, and I've been having it, the struggles with it growing up.
Barbara Moore and David Ogletree both work at VGS, a nonprofit that trains those living with disabilities by giving them hands-on experience. VGS is currently producing 3,000 pairs of trousers a month. And these just aren't any pair of pants. They are made for the women who serve in the Army and Marines. In the basement of VGS, the fabric is first cut into panels to make pants. Next, on the second floor, it takes only 40 minutes for employees to transform the panels into trousers. Barbara sews the buttons, but she also folds and presses the pants. She's worked at VGS for 16 years, and she doesn't let her disability stop her.
Me personally, I don't have a disability. I have a different way of life. When I first started, of course, you know, I had to have brighter lights. They had to raise the machine or lower the machine, you know. But when you're comfortable with doing it after so long, you can do it in your sleep.
David inspects the pants and is as meticulous as if he were in the military.
I always believe that it's good to help those who serve the country.
Sabrina Salinka, general manager of sewing, says they are able to produce high-quality garments by a group some may underestimate with a lot of time and training.
It's definitely something that makes all of us proud. Some of them had dreams of wanting to join the military, but they couldn't. So being here gives them that sense of pride of being able to have a contribution to the military.
Barbara says she loves giving back to the women in the military.
First of all, I love parades. And my favorite part of the parade is the military. And it's like, for some reason, I just get so excited when the military comes on. And I tell whoever's sitting next to me, I say, hey, I help make their uniforms. And they'd be like, wow.
VGS is working on expanding its government contract to possibly make other garments for the military. That way, it will keep these workers producing quality clothing as well as potentially hiring more people with disabilities. For PBS NewsHour, I'm Darielle Snipes in Cleveland.
And three cheers for them. And that's the news.
H&M wants to make a positive contribution to the world. As a long-term buyer in the textile industry and seller in many markets, H&M contributes to international trade. Trade is particularly important for developing countries to take part in, as the jobs, growth, and development it brings help lift people out of poverty. The textile industry is, according to the United Nations Development Programme, an industry well suited to create such progress.
Textile is one of the key economic sectors for us in Bangladesh because it brings almost 80% of our foreign currency and employs more than 4 million people. H&M has been a great partner for us in our initiative towards sustainability and growth.
The majority of the people working in the textile industry in Bangladesh today are women. UN Women states that promoting women's access to economic opportunities contributes to gender equality.
I was born in the village, and I was born in the village. I was born in the village, and I was born in the পরে আমার জীব আমার এই যে দেহ সুন্দর আর আমার জীবন পাল্টে গেল আমার ছেলেকে ভালো স্কুলে পড়ালেখা করাচ্ছি আর আমার ছেলে চাই সে ডাক্তার হবে.
This has an impact on overall labor productivity in the economy and on children's health and well-being within the family, and hence the well-being of the next generation. H&M doesn't own any factories, but works with independent suppliers, who all have to meet H&M's sustainability commitment and code of ethics. In 2015, we did over 3,500 audits and assessments in our suppliers' factories. All 265 manufacturing factories in Bangladesh producing for us has undergone the Accord, building and safety inspections. H&M also provide training on workers' rights to worker and management. 80% of all our suppliers' factories in Bangladesh have so far participated. Moreover, H&M helps suppliers establish democratically elected workplace committees and improve the dialogue between management and employees.
We want to contribute to improvements for the people working in the clothing industry in Bangladesh, and that's why since many years back we have invested a lot of resources to improve the Bangladeshi textile industry. And to take responsibility is a very important part in the total customer offering for us. When it comes to the workers' wages, our standpoint is clear, and that is that we support the workers' demand for higher wages. And during my visit now to Bangladesh, I met with the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, and where we put forward our demand for higher minimum wages and an annual review of the minimum salary.
H&M is also working to ensure that its own purchasing practices enable suppliers to meet H&M's sustainability standards.
For example, by striving to provide long-term business relations, reasonable lead times, fair pricing, timely payments, and transparent communication. HMM works for fair living wages, being paid by all suppliers across the entire textile industry. H&M is the first fashion company to have developed a global strategy for a fair living wage, being paid by all our commercial goods supplier. One important part of the strategy is implementing a fair wage method, which was first piloted in a small number of selected suppliers' factories. The result was positive, and the method is now scaled up to a bigger amount of strategic suppliers' factories in several of our sourcing market. Skills development is key for workers to increase their wages. Providing skills training is part of the work to strengthen workers and help develop the textile industry.
H&M started its training center in 1999 to train the helpers and fresh people and to make sure that they get skills and work as operators in the factory.
The way I see H&M, they're committed to continue this. H&M has been a great strategic partner supporting us in all the positive initiatives. And not only in Bangladesh, H&M also partnered with us in our work in Vietnam and Cambodia in our Better Work program.
H&M welcomes more partnerships and is hopeful that by joining forces, it can contribute to long-term positive development in the textile industry. For more information about H&M's social sustainability work in the supply chain, please visit hm.com/conscious.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool, and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha, and he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha, and now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real-life situations. And so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew, and he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. Not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad, as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in their living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word. And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight, I wish I had it, whatever the case, but you know, I'm not able to do it, I'm out. But instead, he's trying to get money and sell stuff that's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble, and they want $2 million or else they were going to kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot. He doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he had Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in a situation where she has no parents, and he thinks because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead and tried to pull that move with my cousin Vinny. And now he's sitting there looking stupid, but about to end up biting the bullet because he ended up trying to play and get over the wrong dude. These aren't the dorm room kids that you've been serving. And now the only good thing is that Tommy and Ghost are working together. Maybe they may be able to reconcile, but everybody got to keep in mind, Ghost doesn't know Tommy is the one that killed Proctor and shot up his apartment. And Tariq is just sitting there looking stupid while all of this was going down with his lips poked out like he got a trout mouth or something. And he doesn't realize the magnitude of trouble he's in. Now, we know that Vincent really only wanted to keep Tariq because he knew that he could have leverage on Ghost and Tommy. And I think since every episode there's been somebody that died, I believe Vincent is going to die in episode 6. And so that'll be the end of my cousin Vinny. And if he does survive, he's definitely going down in episode 7. But Ghost, he's not going to forget this. He's not going to let this go, that this dude is extorting him, and now in order to come up with $2 million, Ghost is almost broke by between paying Jason and all the different things that he's had to do and the QCP project and things. He's almost broke. Tommy doesn't manage his money right, and he got to pay for the re-up and things, but I'm sure he probably has more money than Ghost right now. And so now Ghost is forced back into the game that he's been trying to get out since the very first episode, thanks to Tariq. And Tasha, it's just going to be a mess because she's got these other dudes that she's working with. My cousin Vinny, he's going to be looking forward to, he thinks he has the upper hand, not realizing once they pay the money and then they get Tariq back, he's screwed. Ghost and Tommy is going to get him for that. They might even get their money back. I don't know how they're going to make $2 million in 24 hours. Even if they get more weight, they're going to have to try to move all that weight in the same day. And that just because you have it doesn't mean all your connects and primaries want to buy that much right now. And so it's going to be one hell of an episode, episode 6, to see how this is going to happen. And even counting up $2 million takes a little bit of time in cash. That's going to take a few hours. Even with the counting machines, they're going to have a couple people just doing that. And so Ghost and Tommy, like he told them, we ain't boys, we ain't cool, but we brothers. And they both got the common interest, which is love for Tariq, even though that boy is an idiot. He keeps calling James Ghost to his face, and then anytime he wants to get hard, he's telling him, get the fork off of me, and he's all in his face with his lips poked out when this dude can't do nothing right. The only person he's ever acted tough in front of is Ghost or the white kids he goes to school with, and they ain't gonna do nothing because he's black, so they automatically are scared. Just like a Chinese dude, you automatically think he know karate, which we all know that's not true either. And so now we see in the previews for episode 6, Tariq is scared. He's shaking like a salt shaker. He got his mouth wide open, lips hanging on the floor. They got a gun pointed near him or at his head. And it looks like either they come close to not being able to pay on time, or they was just messing with him, trying to teach him a lesson not to do nothing stupid like that again. And it's probably in his best interest to get out the game because he doesn't know what he's doing, and he doesn't listen when people try to tell him what's going on. He's sitting there looking stupid. He gonna need to change his baby diapers because his little wee wee probably wet itself after this situation. I hope it did. And what do you all think? You all think Tariq is worth $2 million? If it was your son and he was acting the way he was, would you want to pay $2 million? We all got love for our kids, and yeah, they make mistakes, and in the end of the day, Tariq is young. If it was me, I would not want my son to die, but $2 million, considering how he act, oh my goodness, this would be just a hard situation. Now, if I had millions on deck, that's different. I might have paid, but if I don't have the money and I'm trying to figure it out and do what I need to do, chances are I would still do it because I would love my son. But once he got there, you talk about catching the smackdown, this dude would be getting the brakes beat off of him, and he would be on house arrest. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to put it up here. Y'all vote right here above. Would you save your son? Would love come out stronger than money? Or would you say, forget it, this dude is ruined, he doesn't get it, and he's going to have to pay for his actions? I'm interested to see what you guys vote. Also, out my website, I got it updated weekly with new information, new videos. Also, if you're interested in doing a collaboration or anything, you can catch me there, email me, check out all my social media websites and pages, fan comments, and also check out my Patreon account. That's the home of my true fans, my number one supporters. I appreciate all your support. I provide special, unique content for you. And also, last but not least,
thanks for watching.
Please
leave
a comment,
hit
that like
button,
and subscribe.